Pasadena and are perpetuating it.
The 62nd Annual Conference of the California Library Association is now in session. It is a privilege and pleasure for me to present to you Mr. Grant Changstrom, a member of the City Directors Board, the City of Pasadena. Mr. Changstrom.
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, in attendance at this very wonderful session of the California Library Association, right about now, I think our mayor, Mayor Ray Woods, is performing a similar sort of a ceremony in Mishima, Japan. Mishima is Pasadena's sister city. Under the president's person-to-person program, and Ray has been asked to be over there to assist in the dedication of the Pasadena room. And I'm sure he's having a wonderful time there. But this gives me the great pleasure and delight to be here today, and I feel very honored to be in this capacity. I want to extend the warmest, most sincere welcome to all of you people on behalf of the City of Pasadena, and I'm sure that you're going to have a very successful meeting here, as I've heard you have in other years in other cities. We're really honored not only by your numbers here, but by the dignity and the character of your profession as librarians, a profession that means so much in these very critical days in the education, in the lives of people all over the world. We're really honored to have you in Pasadena for that point alone. Now, may I briefly call to your attention some of the points of interest in Pasadena, if you will have time when you're not in session. Probably one of the most fundamental ones would be attendance at the Pasadena Historical Society exhibit at our central library. This will give you a little of the background of Pasadena, and it's very precious to those who have had a part in the early days of Pasadena and are perpetuating it. But in addition, Pasadena is becoming a city with a new look. Pasadena has found many problems of a maturing city, and certainly included in that is the blight and deterioration of some areas. These are under constant study by the city, and I can assure you with the redevelopment program that has now been embarked upon, you will see in the course of reasonable time some very amazing and appropriate improvements in some of our declining areas. We also have an important part in the national industrial program. We have many firms which are making contributions to our national defense, to our national interest, and firms of all variety of a research and scientific nature. Much of this, I think, has stemmed from the existence of California Institute of Technology, which is one of our important institutions, and I'm sure that you would take great pleasure in seeing the improvement and the expansion and the exciting developments that are going on in their expansion of the campus. Then, too, and this probably is especially of interest to the ladies in the audience, you'd be interested in seeing the new look on Colorado Street and on Lake Avenue with our new shops. You'll be eagerly welcomed, and I'm sure that you would find some very interesting things to see in that area. Again, may I tell you, Madam Chairman, how delighted we are in the city of Pasadena to have you as our guests. We're honored to consider ourselves as hosts for you during this time, and we wish you a very successful session. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Changstrom. It's a great privilege and pleasure always for us to come to Pasadena. I think we all look forward to it, and we certainly appreciate the hospitality of Pasadena, the city, the library, Ms. Donaldson, and all her staff. But I don't know whether you should say anything about those beautiful shops on South Lake, because I'm afraid the next session we're not going to have anybody here. They're all going to be out shopping. I have a telegram I would like to read to you from the American Library Association. Cordial greetings to the California Library Association in convention assembled from the officers and staff of the American Library Association. All good wishes for a successful year ahead. Francis Lander Spain, President, the American Library Association. If you have been looking at your program, you will see that the agenda now says you are going to hear a report of the accomplishments of the California Library Association. I really don't believe you're going to be disappointed when I tell you that I'm going to break with tradition. All CLA members have been kept well informed this year by Bill Eshelman, our editor, of the business transacted at the January and the May board meetings, as well as the programs of CLA through the California Librarian and our newest publication, California Library Affairs. Your institutional membership brings you the full report of all of the sections, committees, and roundtables, and for a fuller understanding of our organization's activities, these may be read later at your leisure, and you'll find them all extremely interesting. So, to repeat this information now would really be a misuse of our short time together, I think. As each CLA president has found, this office requires the moral support and the cooperation from many groups. I am deeply indebted for the success of this year's activities and the personal pleasure the year has brought to me, to the CLA board, the planning committee for this conference, and most especially my own library board of trustees and the board of... of more people. We can help ensure a better read, better informed America, to quote from the National Library Week slogan, by providing good library service to people of all ages throughout the state and making them aware of what that service can mean to them. We must work together to further a program of sound library development in California. Development that will enable our libraries to provide the opportunity to everyone to become better read, better informed. We have... I bid you welcome in the name...
name of Allah, the All-Wise. From far Arabia, I spread a tale before your eyes. You've read of Ali Baba and the 40 thieves, I know. But you were only reading. Now it's acted in a show.
I'm going to ask them to stand as I read their name. And if you would like to show your appreciation of the work that they have given the association this year, I know that they will be just as happy if you wait until the last person has been introduced. President June Bayless, Vice President, President-elect, Dr. Peter T. Conmee, Executive Secretary Treasurer, Mrs. Edna H. Yelland, Immediate Past President, Dr. Alan D. Covey, Counselor, American Library Association, Dr. Lawrence Clark Powell, President, Golden Empire District, Mrs. Margaret C. Dinsmore, President, Golden Gate District, Virginia L. Ross, President, Mount Shasta District, Robert H. Stalen, President, Redwood District, George C. McGladrey, President, Southern District, Hilda M. Glazer, President, Yosemite District, Alice M. Hanna, President, Children's and Young People Section, Mrs. Mary Rogers Smith, President, College, University, and Research Library Section, Dr. Andrew H. Horn, President, Public Library Section, Marjorie C. Donaldson, President, Trustee Section, Mrs. C. E. Klaus. You have received in your registration material an election report of all the officers who will serve in 1961. Because I think you perhaps might not have an opportunity to know who these people are, I would like to read their names and ask them to stand. This is the board that will be serving with Dr. Conmee for the next year, and I think it'd be nice if they would remain standing until all these names, because they rise so quickly you hardly have an opportunity to see them. President, Dr. Peter Conmee. Vice President, President-elect, Dr. Martha T. Bowes. And may I also say, if you have not read your program, that Dr. Bowes has been the General Conference Chairman, and I think all of those of you who enjoy this conference, I hope you'll tell her, because she certainly deserves all the credit in the world. And working with her as the program coordinator has been Dorothy Drake of Scripps College, and although she's not a member of the board, I must tell you that. Retiring President June Bayless, ALA Counselor Dr. Lawrence C. Powell. Dr. Powell, I don't believe, is here. I think he has a class this morning. Executive Secretary Treasurer, Mrs. Edna H. Yelland. Mrs. Yelland is in the back, standing in the back. I hope you see her. Golden Empire District President John M. Sakarek. Golden Gate District President Carl A. Vollmeyer. Mount Shasta District President Florence E. Biller. Redwood District President George C. McGladrey. Southern District President Raymond M. Holt. Yosemite District President Alice M. Hanna. Children's and Young People Section President Francis Lee. College, University, and Research Library Section, Elizabeth Reynolds. Public Library Section President, Esther L. Marden. And Trustee Section President, S. Lee Vavoris. You're going out of office, officers, and you're coming into office, officers, have been presented to you. I have one announcement that was left up at the roster here. The Librarians Workshop of all prison librarians will be held on Thursday from 8:30 to 12:30 a.m. in Parlor B at the Huntington Hotel here. It is a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Horn, the president of the College, University, and Research Libraries section, the sponsor of our program. Dr. Horn.
Mr. Shangstrom, Ms. Bayless, officers, members, and friends of the association. The College, University, and Research Libraries section is highly honored in being permitted to sponsor this, the first general session of the 62nd Annual Conference of the Association. And as a consequence, I am allowed the great pleasure of introducing our keynote speaker, Professor Linus Pauling. Mrs. Pauling is also the Association's guest this morning. Mrs. Pauling, will you rise and be recognized, please?
Thank you.
As soon as President Bayless, with her executive board and conference planning committee, determined that the theme of this conference should be people, the reason for libraries, it became evident that we must have an opening address by a person who understood the forces which are at present revolutionizing our society, a person aware of what science and technology are doing to and for the people we serve. So that in hearing him, we librarians might hope better to serve our publics and anticipate their future needs. We would also want our speaker for this occasion to be a person concerned with the effects of the wartime and post-war scientific discoveries upon values within our social structure, one sensitive to human rights and the dignity of man as an individual. With these specifications before us, in one voice we said, Linus Pauling. It was a happy circumstance that he should be a resident of the city in which we meet. And with the generosity for which he is known to Southern California librarians, to whom he has spoken on many occasions, Dr. Pauling agreed to take time from his research and teaching and his defense of civil liberties to be with us. We are grateful. We're fully aware, Dr. Pauling, that matters of pressing importance have been put aside in order for you to be here. Linus Pauling, native of Oregon, educated there and also here, the California Institute of Technology, a member of the faculty of the Institute since 1922, and for over 20 years, chairman of its Division of Chemistry and Engineering, visiting professor at Oxford, California, Illinois, MIT, and other colleges and universities, is one of the world's distinguished scientists. Most of his scientific work has dealt with the nature of the chemical bond, including experimental studies on the structure of crystals by X-ray diffraction and the structure of gas molecules by electron diffraction. He's been concerned with the magnetic properties of substance, the nature of serological systems, structure of antibodies and proteins, the role of abnormal hemoglobins in relation to anemia, abnormal enzymes in relation to mental disease. In addition, he's carried on theoretical studies in the application of quantum mechanics to the structure of molecules, and so forth, and so forth. In recent years, much of his work has been on the application of chemistry to biological and medical problems. He's published a half a dozen books and some 300 scientific papers, not including many articles on social and political questions, especially on peace. For his discoveries and the publication of his findings, he's been honored throughout the world. The 1954 Nobel Prize in Chemistry, the American Chemical Society Award in Pure Chemistry, the Nichols Medal, the Gilbert Newton Lewis Medal, the Aguavardo Medal, the Pasteur Medal, the Pierre Fermat Medal, the Sabatier Medal, the Davy Medal of the Royal Society, the Phillips Medal of the American College of Physicians, the Grotius Medal for contributions to international law. Cambridge, Oxford, London, Paris, Berlin, Yale, Princeton, Chicago, and eight other universities here and abroad have bestowed honorary doctoral degrees upon him. Active in the American Chemical Society, of which he has been president, the American Philosophical Society, the Royal Society of London, he's been elected an honorary member of the academies of science in many lands, for example, those of France, Norway, the USSR, India, Italy, Belgium, and Portugal. Merit for exceptionally meritorious conduct in the performance of outstanding services to the United States from 1940 to 1946. This busy man, however, has never been so busy as to lose a concern for humanity and society. He has crusaded actively when academic freedom or civil liberties have been threatened. Even when he could easily and with justification have avoided such sacrifice, he has patiently and courageously sacrificed to the very point of risking his personal freedom and security in defense of the principles for which the free world claims to stand. He has in recent weeks conducted himself as an inspiring example in the cause of human freedom and dignity. In the endeavor for peace, as in the realm of pure science, he is one of this nation's great assets, a source of our national strength and security. Hopeful that such strength and security may someday be the experience of all everywhere. Dr. Pauling, I proudly present you as a scientist, teacher, humanitarian, friend of libraries and librarians to speak on the topic of your choice, the molecular theory of civilization.
The world is made up of matter and radiation. Matter is the part of the world that has rest mass, that weighs something when it's standing still. Radiation is the part that doesn't weigh anything, in fact, disappears when it's standing still. It always moves with the velocity of light, photons and neutrinos, perhaps some other things. Scientists are interested in studying the world. The study of the world in an objective manner is science, and I have been interested in this for many years. I've had the privilege of seeing a very great increase in our knowledge about the nature and structure of the world, how electrons and nuclei are combined together to form atoms, and how they group together to form molecules, and so on. Practically all of our precise knowledge of molecular structure has been obtained during my lifetime. 35 years ago, it wasn't known that the water molecule H2O has its two protons, the two hydrogen atoms out at the distance, not 0.965 angstrom from the oxygen atom, and that the angle between the bonds is 104 degrees 30 minutes. This is new information, just about 30 years old now, and we have information of this sort now for hundreds, even thousands of molecules, including some that make up the human body. Moreover, I've discovered that as I have grown older, I have become interested in philosophy, in philosophical and ethical questions. Philosophy is the subjective study of the world by man. It involves thinking. For a long time, I hesitated to attack this problem. I felt just about the way that my friend Professor Bridgman, P.W. Bridgman of Cambridge, of Harvard University, felt and feels. In his recent book, he said, "Two convictions have been growing upon me. A conviction of the importance of a better understanding of the nature and the limitations of our intellectual tools, and a conviction that there is some fundamental ineptness in the way that all of us handle our minds. It becomes more and more impossible for me to read any of the great philosophical works which have excited universal admiration from the time of the early Greeks. My mind simply will not do the things that it is obviously expected to do. The recent Treasury of Philosophy by Dagobert Runes is to me an utterly depressing exhibition of human frailty. Well, I too was depressed by the old philosophical writings, but I feel better about them now because I think that I understand what has been going on. I don't think that it's possible to separate philosophy and science. Science is a very important part of the world, which was closed to the old philosophical writers, and their thinking was restricted for that reason. I felt better in recent years as I have come to accept this fact and to decide that I would better pay more attention to my own thoughts and to the writings and statements of my contemporaries than to these old fellows. Well, we have gained a great deal of information about the world, especially during the last few years, the last 50 years. The amount of scientific knowledge doubles every 12 years, and this means a very great increase that has come to us recently. A most surprising development during the last few years is the discovery of the molecular structure of the gene. We know something about what makes human beings what they are and how they pass their characters on to the next generation. This I shan't have time to talk about very much, but let me say a word about the genes. We know that the gene is a molecule of deoxyribose nucleic acid. We know this pretty definitely. It's a pretty big molecule containing perhaps a million atoms, the average gene. A person inherits about 100,000 of them, 50,000 from his father and 50,000 from his mother. Even though they are big molecules as molecules go, and 100,000 is a pretty good size number, and 3 billion, the number of people in the world, is a pretty large amount. Nevertheless, all of these molecules that have determined the nature of all of the human beings living on Earth would, if they were gathered together, be about the size of a pinhead, a cubic millimeter. So that each one of us has inherited an extremely small amount of material, the 100,000 genes, that have determined essentially what he is today. His environment has influenced him to some extent too, but this is most of the, this has been the determining factor really, these 100,000 genes. Moreover, it is known now, I think I can say that it is known now in a reasonably precise way, how the gene manufactures a duplicate of itself. This is the Watson-Crick structure of the gene. I wish that I had time to talk about it, but there are so many things I want to say that I shall just say that this is an astounding development of the last few years that has changed the thinking of all of the scientists in the world with respect to genetics and evolution. We even are learning something about what molecules do in relation to disease. About a dozen years ago, one of my students, Harvey Tono, now back in Bethesda, and two or three other people involved with him too, but Harvey did the main job, discovered for the first time an abnormal molecule that causes a disease in human beings, a serious disease, sickle cell anemia. People are born who have inherited two genes. The genes that produce an abnormal hemoglobin molecule instead of the normal hemoglobin molecules that are present in most human beings. The hemoglobin molecule, red stuff inside the red corpuscles, contains about 10,000 atoms. It's a pretty good-sized molecule, and quite a lot, although not everything is known about its structure. These abnormal sickle cell anemia hemoglobin molecules have about a dozen atoms that are different out of the 10,000 that are different from those in normal hemoglobin. These dozen atoms, this abnormality causes the molecules to stick together so that they clump together to form a sort of crystal inside the red cell in the venous blood. And as this crystal grows, it twists the red cell out of shape, the spleen destroys it very rapidly, the patient becomes anemic, he leads a life, a short life of suffering, and dies early. About one Negro child in 400 who is born has inherited these two genes and dies of this disease, sickle cell anemia. Now, We come to a clean-cut ethical problem. There are among the people in the world some millions, many millions, perhaps 20 millions, who carry a gene for sickle cell anemia. They have, out of their 100,000 genes, one gene that manufactures normal hemoglobin molecules and one that manufactures sickle cell molecules. And in their red cells, they have a 50-50 mixture of these two kinds, the normal and abnormal molecules. They get along all right because the normal molecules dilute the abnormal ones enough so that they don't get into trouble. They aren't anemic. But when two of these heterozygotes marry one another, then there occurs the great lottery, the greatest of all lotteries. A child inherits one of the two genes of the father and one of the two genes of the mother. He has a 25% chance of inheriting both of the abnormal genes and of having the disease sickle cell anemia, which will cause him to suffer as a child and perhaps through youth and to die. Rarely do they live as long as 20 into the 20s. We can tell very easily with just a single drop of blood which people carry the abnormal gene and whether two people who have married one another have a 25% chance for each child that they produce that he will lead this life of suffering. So what should be done? This gene now is being got rid of. Perhaps in a few minutes I'll say why there are so many people who have it. It's being got rid of now, and in the course of 10 or 20 generations, there will be only half as many people carrying this gene if the population of the Earth stays constant. Were to stay constant, it would have dropped down to half. And then after another 10 or 20 generations, to half of that. As the children who inherited the two abnormal genes die without progeny after leaving the life of suffering. Now, is there any alternative in the purification of the pool of human germplasm to this process that involves so much human suffering and death? And the answer is yes, the alternative is the ethical alternative that these children not be born. We can tell a pair of parents or prospective parents whether or not their children have this 25% chance of being born. I think that the principle of minimum suffering tells us what to do. Man is what he is today because of his power of thought, his reason, and I believe that the time has come for him to use this power to decrease the amount of suffering in the world. I believe that these people should be told when it's discovered that there are two of these heterozygotes who have married one another, that they should not, if they haven't yet married one another, they should not marry one another. Even if they marry someone who isn't a carrier of the gene, we might recommend that they have a smaller number than average of children, because half their children, in the case of marriage between a normal person and a heterozygote, half the people will also be heterozygotes carrying the defective gene, half the children. But if they have married one another, they should not have children, in my opinion. And parents of a sickle cell anemia child should have no further children. They should voluntarily restrict their progeny. This is a matter of ethics, of philosophy, in the sense that philosophy involves the analysis and clarification of human actions and aims, problems, and ideals. This is the definition that Carlos Lamont gives it. Well, many admirable statements about ethics and philosophy have been made in the past. Dr. Schweitzer has said that we need new thoughts, too, in this field. As Aristotle says, everyone has a philosophy, whether he knows it or not. I think that it is better to follow a philosophy that you have accepted after thought and analysis than one that you have got through the accident of circumstance. I think that there is much to be said for the philosophy of humanism, that the chief end of human life is to work for the happiness of man upon this earth, or perhaps also on the moon, soon other other planets. Humanism is a rational philosophy. It rejects the mysticism and supernaturalism of the revealed religions. It rejects life after death and the idea that suffering in this world may for the righteous be compensated for by the bliss of an afterlife, for which we have no evidence other than that in Revelation. Included in this rejection of the supernatural is the rejection of a belief in an omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent God who watches over and cares for human beings, interfering with the ordered regularity of events as determined by national laws, sometimes in response to prayer. My own peace of mind has become considerably greater after my accepting the idea that arbitrary action by a supernatural being will not change the course of the world. I believe in law and order, and I am happy to have law and order in the world. Humanism is a philosophy of service for the good of all humanity, application of new ideas, scientific progress for the benefit of men, all men, those now living and those still to be born. Children who might suffer from sickle cell anemia. I accept humanism in the main, but I feel that perhaps it is limited in its emphasis on human beings. Shouldn't we instead accept Schweitzer's principle of reverence for life, not just for human beings, for life? In fact, I want to go further and advocate a principle of reverence for the world. Reverence for the inanimate as well as the animate part of the world. This is a wonderful world that we live in. Some of its wonders are being annihilated, destroyed as time goes on so that our children's children will never be able to experience them. I do not like to see beautiful crystals of galena, malachite, azurite, pyrite, and so on, removed from the ground and destroyed just to make more copper wire for ICBMs and uranium rods for plutonium reactors. Instead of the principle of maximizing human happiness, I prefer the principle of minimizing suffering in the world, not only human suffering, but all suffering. Now, the difference between these principles involves weighting factors. If we take a scale determined by income, we may select as an origin an income that enables people to lead a moderately satisfactory life, and then an increase by 80% in this income would increase happiness for the individual to some percent, some extent, but a decrease by 80% would cause a great amount of suffering. This is why I put the emphasis on suffering rather than on happiness. The Sheikh of Kuwait has an income of $300 million a year, piling up in banks and being used to buy thousands of Cadillacs, some of them gold-plated and so on. Yet he lives there in Kuwait, surrounded by poverty and misery, and occasionally builds a school or does something for the welfare of the Arab people. This seems to me to represent misuse, something wrong with our system. I think that surely the path for us to follow with respect to the gene for sickle cell anemia is not to allow the millions of children to be born, suffer, and die in order to remove this gene from the pool, but rather to use the alternative method of preventing the children from being born. In this matter of birth control, of course, people no longer look to the church for leadership. Long ago, church officials ceased to be the wise men of the community who analyzed world problems and formulated the principles of behavior that would be of greatest benefit to the world. Now the church tends to follow behind the people as the world changes. It tends to preserve the old values, the values that were formulated and were proper values for the world of some 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. Well, there are other genes, too, that we need to do something about. Phenylketonuria, for example. Children who have inherited two abnormal genes in place of the normal genes that would manufacture an enzyme in the liver that catalyzes the oxidation of an amino acid, phenylalanine, to tyrosine in normal human beings. These children have a serious disease that involves mental defect. 1% of the institutionalized cases of mental defect in the country are due to this gene, the gene for phenylketonuria. My colleagues under our Ford Foundation project grant out at the California Institute of Technology have developed a reliable test for the people who carry this bad gene. And the one test, of course, is to have a child, for two people to have a child who is mentally deficient because of phenylketonuria. This is a good test. It shows that each of them carries the gene. One person in 80 carries this gene. Each of them carries the gene. They shouldn't have any more children because there's a 25% chance for each succeeding child that he will be defective in this way. Well, my colleagues have developed a test that will tell whether you carry this gene or not without your having a mentally deficient child. It's not too easy a test, but it can be carried out and is pretty reliable. It has been applied. A man who, with his first wife, who has since died, had a phenylketonuric child, wanted to be married again. He brought his fiancée to the laboratory. She was investigated, and it was found that she did not carry the gene. He was able then to get married with peace of mind, knowing that he and his wife, new wife, would not have a mentally deficient child with phenylketonuria. There are a great many diseases now, thousands of diseases that cause much suffering in the world that have this cause. Only a few of them are diseases for which it can be predicted ahead of time that a child who will be born will have a 25% or perhaps a 50% chance of having the gene. As work continues to be done, we shall have better and better knowledge, better and better powers of prediction. And although it is a very difficult problem of how to act in certain simple cases, such as those I have described, it is clear what should be done. And we can see that man will be able to use his knowledge and powers of reason to decrease the amount of suffering in the world. Well, how did the world come to be what it is today? We know how it came about and how the human species arose. We know what the process of evolution is. Some 2 billion years ago, there was in the world, produced by photochemical reactions and electrochemical reactions involving high energy light quanta from the sun and lightning and other causes, there was on the world a great mass of material that we call organic material, molecules of all sorts involving carbon. Then a self-duplicating molecule arose and started to manufacture duplicates of itself. And we understand this process of how a molecule can manufacture duplicates of itself. More of these were produced, and they competed with one another. The best ones won out. This evolution is inevitable. From our knowledge of molecules and their interactions, it is easy for us to see that this would have gone on. The first self-duplicating molecule was in clover. Plenty of spare parts around, all sorts of molecules there, all the amino acids and everything else that it might use to build up the bigger molecules that constituted itself. After a while, it may have produced so many duplicates of itself, so much progeny, that one of these important substrate molecules that it used, let's say, as food, became exhausted. Then what happened? One of my colleagues, Professor Norman Horowitz, in the biology division at the Institute, is the man who has clarified this matter, has answered this question. He said, this is what happened. After a while, a cosmic ray or some other mutagenic agent caused one of these many self-duplicating molecules to undergo a mutation such as to permit it to manufacture the missing molecule, the depleted molecule, from other molecules that were present. For example, vitamin B1 consists of two parts, a thiazole part and a pyrimidine part. Some organisms take thiazole and pyrimidine and put them together to make vitamin B1, and others can't, man among them. The original organism presumably could do that and could even manufacture, perhaps he started out by using thiazole and pyrimidine and then putting them together to make vitamin B1. As thiazole and pyrimidine became depleted, perhaps he used the vitamin B1 itself to start out. practically everything must have been present on Earth after it had been subjected to these influences for several billion years. When the vitamin B1 was depleted, one of these organisms mutated in such a way that it had the power to combine the thiazole and the pyrimidine part. That was a favorable mutation. And that organism took over the world. The others couldn't compete with it because they were their diet was restricted. There wasn't any B1 around, and they didn't know how to make it. Well, of course, as time has gone by, some organisms, which began to eat other organisms, have lost some of these abilities. The red bread mold, for example, can synthesize all of the 20 amino acids, and man can synthesize only 13 of them. It has to get the other 7 in its food. The rat can synthesize vitamin C, but man has forgotten how. In the process of evolution, he's unable to synthesize vitamin C. These genes that we have inherited are really remarkable in that they are passed on from generation to generation. They manufacture duplicates of themselves with very few errors. The rate of mutation is such that we are able to say that genes manufacture duplicates of themselves on the average for 3 million years before a mistake is made. The average gene goes on for something like 100,000 generations, producing a duplicate to pass on to the next generation without a mistake until, on the average, once in 100,000 generations, 3 million years. And yet, although genes are very stable, we know that they are very stable. A couple of my colleagues, boys working with me, Dr. Jones and Dr. Zuckerkandel, have completed a study of the hemoglobin of human beings and of animals. The hemoglobin molecule contains about 10,000 atoms. The gorilla hemoglobin molecule and the chimpanzee hemoglobin molecule differ from human hemoglobin molecule by a barely detectable amount, something like a half dozen atoms out of 10,000. The orangutan hemoglobin is somewhat more different, a dozen or 20 atoms out of 10,000. And then as you go down to horse and pig, we don't know yet, but it's a much bigger difference. To fish, still a bigger difference, but some similarities. And to a worm, Euricus, local beach worm here, there you find very little resemblance. From this, we can conclude that the gene for hemoglobin has been essentially the same for a long time, millions of years, before the time, from long before the time when human beings and gorillas and